getting a citation because you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, so to speak. So I call that entrapment. Legalistically, it's not entrapment. I'm using the word entrapment in the way that the general public uses the word. Legalistically, entrapment would mean that somebody held a gun to your head and forced you to do something that's illegal. Of course, they haven't done that in this particular case. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call letters right now, KQRIW and the TechNet.
Did they publish their letter?
No, they did not. I predicted they would not publish the letter because it contained mathematics. There was no letter in Newsday, Letter Together, that I had ever seen that contained mathematics. There's another thing they told me. The letter has to be cut down by 5 to 1 in length before they will publish it. You've read that letter, Eric. If I cut it down to 20% of the words that were there, do you believe I could still get the point across? I'm very skeptical. You'd have to leave out so much that it would become arm waving and nobody would believe it. So I'm going to have to find some other way of publishing it as a opinion article, not a letter to the editor. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yes, there's a couple of very simple solutions to this, but you have to stop thinking like an engineer. Start thinking like a dumbass person. What you would do is, you don't need the mathematics. You can just give the very simple, in English, that the light's too damn short, and there's a couple particular spots on the road that if you just happen to be lucky enough to be there, you're going to get a ticket. If you want more information, please go to this URL, and you can get the specifics, and that'll get published.
And where is that URL where that letter will exist? I don't have a website, per se, where... Now, people could send a private email to me, and I could ship them back a letter, but that's going to be a pain.
Oh, no, you don't want to do that.
Okay, therefore, your recommendation is?
Talk to your son. He knows all about this stuff. There are many, many sites where you can put a singular thing to be viewed. It takes less than 5 minutes. You'll get a really funky-looking URL, but if you're really smart about it, you can get a shortened URL, too. But, you know, you have to make the effort.
Okay, I'll have to have a further conversation with the computer maiden in my house, my son, KB2IQN. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in tonight. One last call. Anybody else with any questions or comments before we go over to the mailbag? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Short question, Dick.
Okay, Vito, go right ahead.
Ted, K2CJE, did you ever get that book from the mega company over?
You're going to have to give me more information. K2GJE, repeat what you just said. Go ahead.
Ted again. I think a couple of weeks ago I spoke about a book you could get free from the mega company on grounding. Discussed the length of ground rods, number of ground rods, etc. Over.
Yeah, my son says Mega is a sharing site, and you're asking, did I go there and look at that? No, I'm sorry to say I didn't. Go ahead.
I had given you an address, I think also a phone number that you could use, over.
Okay, I'll have to go back and review that. And so I'm a bit forgetful when I get a lot of emails, so I may not have responded correctly to that one. Okay, I think it's time to go over to the mailbag. And what kind of scientific questions have we got this week, John? Are they trying to snow us again? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. We have some interesting questions, and from two very young students. But first, let's see. I have a question about RFID tags. Let me know your drop, and I'll go on with that question. Okay, I have a gentleman who's interested in what degrades an ID RFID tag. Sort of like any type of radiation, whether it be magnetic or maybe pulse, ultraviolet rays. Is there anything that deteriorates the performance of RFID tags? Why he's asking this, I don't know, but that's his question. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
John, I think that's a fairly valid question. Now, when it comes to degrading an RFID tag, there's at least two classes of degradation. Yes, there's something you can do, like exposing it to ultraviolet or x-rays or whatever, that in a long period of time is going to give you degraded performance. That's possible. But the more likely degradation is electromagnetic interference. There's some other RF source nearby that can stop it from working correctly. Let me give you a quick description first of what RFID is and what it's capable of doing. The most popular long-range RFID is the ones that work at 915 megacycles. That's the center frequency. It must hop in frequency between 902 and 928 in a particular sequence, a pseudo-random sequence, so that you're not dwelling on any one frequency with the reader. The reader is allowed to run 1 watt of power into a 6 dB gain antenna. So 4 watts of effective radiated power is what the reader is allowed to have if it's using frequency hopping, and therefore it's a license-free service. Let me drop. So that's what the handheld reader is doing. Not all of them are handheld. In some cases, you've got an antenna at the door of a warehouse, at the dock door, that's reading all the tags that's on the stuff that's on the pallet that's going through the door by way of the forklift truck, if you know what I mean. And you could read as many as 500 tags per second under ideal conditions like that. The tag itself is receiving RF energy from the reader, 4 watts of ERP, and if the tag is one of the modern-day very sensitive ones in a good location, it is capable of being read at slightly more than 20 feet of range. So you could have a tag pasted on the side of a cardboard box in a warehouse where you've misplaced that particular perishable equipment. It's three shelves high and two objects back on the shelf, and you could, in theory, be 20 feet away from that. The handheld reader, you've told it to look for tag number 45, so to speak, and you wave that reader around as you go up and down the aisles, and when you're within 20 feet of that tag, it starts beeping back at you. The tag beeps back 96 bits of information, and that's a tag identification and any other story you want to write onto that tag. The tag itself, let me drop. In most cases, it's on a thin piece of plastic. The tag is about 4 inches long, half an inch wide or so. That's the printed circuit dipole that's on that piece of plastic. And if you look with a magnifying glass or with a microscope, in the center of that dipole is a little black dot, about a 32nd of an inch or a 64th of an inch square. And inside of that little black dot is all the electronics that does all this. It rectifies some of the RF energy coming from your interrogator. That charges the capacitor on board. The capacitor becomes the temporary battery that runs the integrated circuit chip that's in that little black dot. That little black dot now starts speaking back to you the 96 bits of code, and it does that by modulating the impedance of the antenna. So therefore, the free space reflection from the antenna, the fact that the antenna flips back and forth between a 50-ohm load, a 70-ohm load and a short circuit, so to speak, means that the reflected energy from the tag jumps up and down with a digital code, and that's the 96 bits that it talks back to you on. So no battery on board is required. The thing can work for many, many years if it's properly treated, and up to 20 foot of range is possible with a state-of-the-art antenna RFID reader on a tag that's well mounted. Let me drop.
Not easy pass.
Get the Easy Pass at the end of this, which is a fairly different service. Well, Easy Pass does have a battery on board. Therefore, it is not a thoroughly passive. The tag I just described to you is a thoroughly passive tag. Easy Pass is called semi-passive. That is to say, the battery drastically increases the receiver function sensitivity on the tag. Therefore, it's got a hell of a lot more range. The uplink to the tag is the limiting factor. When you're more than 20 feet away, the tag is not getting its minimum power. It needs in the vicinity of minus 16 dBm out of that 915 megacycle dipole in order to rectify enough power to turn the thing on so it wakes up. So the uplink, so to speak, to the tag is the usual limiting factor. But if you've got a battery on board like Easy Pass does have, then that range to the uplink can go from 20 feet to 300 feet real fast because you put a battery on board. Let me drop. And that battery on Easy Pass, I think, is good for something like 5 years, 7 years, in that order. And then you have to trade in the Easy Pass. Before we leave that one, you've used Easy Pass for a while. What's the approximate life of that battery in which you have to replace the Easy Pass, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, there's good ones last about 5 years. I've seen, we had one that lasted only about 2 years. It was probably a manufacturing defect in the battery, but I've caused the Easy Pass not to read by transmitting on UHF at the same time while I was going through the toll of the city. You know, they'd have the gates to come flying down on you.
Yeah, well done, Eric, because you've now entered into that second point I was going to talk about, and that's what stops the RFID tag from operating as much as 20 feet. Because it's operating at 915 megs and the only frequency selective object on that tag, and the tag is worth about 20 cents, by the way, on the 20 cent tag, the only thing that's selecting the frequency is the length of that dipole antenna. So you transmit any amount of significant RF energy from, let me pick a number, 800 megs to 1,000 megs, the dipole will pick up enough, and it now will interfere with the operation. And it could be both a positive as well as a negative interference. If you're running a cell phone the right distance away, so that the energy from the cell phone is being picked up by the tag, rectified, and it's now powering the capacitor, the battery, but the frequency is not close enough so that it's interfering with the uplink interrogator. The interrogator starts off with a handshake of a kind, where it tells the tag to wake up and talk to me at this time. And it might be a selective talk. In other words, it might say only tags where the identification begins with A41, talk to me. A41 blank, 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 so to speak. Those take to me. Or every tag, talk to me. So there's a kind of a handshake in the beginning that has to be read before the tag will start reading out its information. Let me drop it. So there were various kinds of RF emitters you could have nearby, like your 2-meter or your UHF transmitter, which could interfere with that operation, so that it's got a very simple rectifier on board looking for the leading edge and the trailing edges of the pulses coming from the interrogator that is the beginning of that handshake information. And so if you're giving it so much RF energy that it can no longer see the leading edges and trailing edges of the square wave pulses coming from the interrogator, then it's not going to respond. So that's the usual. And there's another whole class of ways that the tag can become degraded, and that is to recognize the fact that the world's best UHF dummy load is water. You take that tag and tape it to the side of a bottle of soda water or ordinary water, anything that contains water. And the tag that used to have 20 foot of range might now have a range of 3 feet. And I'm not kidding. Let me drop. Because the water is now a highly lossy, absorptive substance within the near-field range of the dipole antenna, it can easily cut down the range from 20 feet to 3 feet. And so you can still read that tag when it's pasted up against a bottle of water, but you've got to be a hell of a lot closer before you can read it, in the worst case. Also, putting it against a metallic object can detune the tag. Now, there's a whole class of tags that are made where there's a thick piece of foam between the plastic antenna of the tag, the dipole, and the mounting surface, the peel-and-stick glue on the back. There's a specific thickness of foam such that it is tuned to be against the metallic substance. So you can buy tags that are made to be fully operational when they're up against a piece of metal. But you just take an ordinary tag and paste it to a piece of metal, and if you put it directly flat against a piece of sheet metal, I think your reading range might go down to 1 foot. That's even worse than water, if you know what I mean. You're really, literally shorting out the antenna RF-wise. So these tags can tolerate an awful lot. I'm almost positive that you could design a tag. Let me drop.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. I'm going to get to you in a second, Paul. You could design a tag so that you literally lay it against the 330 kilovolt wire that's transmitting 5,000 amperes, And so it's the kind of tag that's got a piece of foam that's made to be mounted against a piece of metal. You could mount that tag on that 335 kilovolt lighter. The tag could be designed in such a way that it's measuring local magnetic field, which is current. And now you stand on the ground with your interrogator, and you read out that tag. It'll tell you how many amperes are flowing through that particular piece of wire, even though it's in the middle of a 5,000 ampere magnetic field. And that wouldn't be damaging to the tag if the whole thing is properly designed. That would be a beautiful way of monitoring each of the three wires at various locations along a high tension power distribution system, power transmission system. Paul, it sounds like you want to know more about the RFID, WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
I heard on the news today on our CBS radio that they're doing away with the toll booths that happen at the bridge. I don't know if this is going to be the first of many different toll booths where they're going to do away with it, but they're keeping the easy pass people for now. But if you don't have an easy pass, you just zoom through and they're going to be taking pictures of your license plate, and you wind up getting a bill home in the mail sometime in the future. So I guess that's going to eliminate a lot of problems with people that with battery problems or, who knows what kind of problems. They'll just take a picture and send you a bill. I think you got a year and a half to pay, some kind of crazy number. I don't know how many times you can go through. So you'll be able to coast through around 20 miles an hour, and eventually they're going to do away with the toll booths altogether. Back to you, Dick.
KE2KB with a question.
KE2KB recognized. Paul, it makes a lot of sense to be electronic reading at a toll booth. A similar set of experiments took place more than 2 years ago. It was called U.S. Visits. In other words, at the borders of the United States, there's an RFID tag that is or is going to be put into our passports, and therefore, as you drove through the border at 30 miles an hour, the equipment at the border was going to read the RFID tag that's in your passport, and if the passport had the right identification, if the automobile had the right license plate, if everything came together, the gate didn't go down, and you keep driving at 30 miles an hour through a border. As I said, that was called U.S. Visits. And a whole set of experiments took place. The most difficult portion of that experiment was that if what's going through the border happens to be a bus full of people, and all of the people have got their passport out and they're holding it up against the window, would the system be able to read all of those RFID tags on all of those passports of all those people on that bus as it drove through? And a bunch of experiments along those lines took place, and most of the time the answer was yes. Let me drop. But there are certain conditions in which you might miss one or two of those passports and the RFID tag that's built into them. If the person is holding his hand across the critical portion of the passport, where he is creating an RF short, so to speak, to the antenna of the RFID tag that's in there, then it might have trouble reading it. So this idea of having the right kind of instrumentation that can either read your easy pass while you're going through at a reasonable number of miles an hour, that could save a lot of time of making change and stopping at the toll booth. So it stands to reason that electronic reading at toll booths is going to become more popular, as I see it.
Question, Dick.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, John.
EC2WGB. Couldn't it be worked out where if you're boarding a bus, you would swipe your passport RFID on a device on the bus? When the bus gets to that location, it could dump the whole file that it has. This way it wouldn't have to wait for people holding it upside down or whatever in the windows, and might eliminate some of that problem.
That's a good suggestion, John. And I don't remember that being suggested at the time. But as I said, a number of these experiments took place at the border or at a trial border in near Washington, D.C., in order to validate the system. And at that time of the experiment, the winter of 2013, I think it was, they came to the conclusion that all the bugs are not out of the system yet in order to deploy it. So a bunch of those experiments were taking place. KE2, Kilo Bravo, please tell us your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW, the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi, Dick. This is KE2KB, and the name is Frank, and I'm in Teaneck, New Jersey. I just happened to have been walking on the Appalachian Trail in Dutchess or Putnam County. I'm not sure exactly where I was. Passing underneath a series of high tension lines, there were major high power lines, probably a feeder from Canada to New York City. And I saw white strips on the wires some distance away from the tower. And I'm wondering now that you mention it, whether that's some kind of RFID, like you said, to read the current. Because I looked at those and they look kind of funny. I've never seen something like that before.
Yeah, up till now, I've been giving you this information about reading current with an RFID tag as a speculation of a capability. Most likely, if you were doing it, you would be doing it at the 915 megacycle region. By the way, RFID tags can be made at 135 kilohertz, 13.75 megahertz, 27 megahertz. In Europe, they use them at 450 megahertz region, 800 and some odd megahertz region. There are tags that can be made at S-band, C-band, and so on. In other words, 2 1/fraction gigs, 5 1/fraction gigs, but the ones with the longest range, the ones with the highest reliability at long range, seem to be the ones at either 400 or 900 megacycles. So in the United States, the 915 meg tags are the ones with the longest range, and that tag is in the vicinity of 4.5 inches long. If you are below, let me drop it. If you are below a high tension power transmission system, and those towers are typically 150 feet or even higher in height, therefore you are a healthy 150 feet away from that wire, I'm having trouble believing you would be able to see a white piece of plastic that's only 4.5 inches long. So that might not be an RFID tag. What's your guess as to the length of the white piece of plastic you saw, Frank? KE2 Kilo Bravo, K2RIW on the TechNet.
It had to be more than 4 inches for sure. It had to be probably a foot or two long.
I guess it could still be an RFID tag. It could be one that's operating at a lower frequency, like 13 megahertz is one of the next frequencies down, 13.56, I think it is, megahertz. Some of these tags that they put on television sets, for instance, that read whether or not you've paid for the object at the checkout counter before going through the front door of the building, many of those are operated at 13 megahertz. So interesting to keep track of those. There's a lot of future for these things. In the beginning, there was a wildly over-enthusiastic acceptance of RFID tags because people believed they're going to completely replace barcodes. No way. Let me drop a question. HUC with a question. Steve, I guess it is recognized. A barcode only gives you 12 or 13 bits of information if it's a one-dimensional barcode. Those are the ones that are a fraction of a penny each, and they're ubiquitous. They're on everything you buy. You go to the checkout counter when they work very well. But only 13 bits means that there's a lot of reuse of the code, so to speak. Whereas an RFID tag is 96 bits of information. That's the good news. But the tag is 20 cents, not a half a penny. So people thought that the RFID is going to replace barcode. Not at all. They each complement each other. There are places where one is a lot more cost-effective than the other. There's no point I was going to make along those lines. Let's see now. Cost, bits, capabilities, range. In the case of a barcode, you've got to be able to see the object with your laser scanner. Whereas in the case of RFID, the thing could be 20 feet away from you behind two boxes, and you can't see it. Yet the thing can talk back to you saying, "Here I am, come get it," if you know what I mean. So each has its advantages. And so there was wild enthusiasm in the beginning of RFID. Then it went to the valley of despair for a while, and now it's climbing back out. It's coming back into popularity if you know what I mean. So it's here with us. It's going to be around for a long period of time, in my opinion. And as time goes on, let me drop it. The tags will get a little bit more elaborate. You can now buy a tag.
Didn't let it drop long enough.
Yeah, I'm listening on 375 now, and it just came back. Okay, the tags are, you can buy a special tag which has a lot more than 96 bits, where you can literally write a story in there. You can ship something from Hong Kong that's going to go to three different ports before it gets to you in New York, and at each one of those ports you can write a story as to when it arrived, when it left, what was the temperature, humidity, was the package open, and so on. All that information can be written into this little tag, and a little black dot in the center will contain all that information, and you might not even be able to see the little black dot without a magnifying glass. I think it was Steve that just called us. Or was it Steve or was it John? Whoever it was that just called me, go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah,
Jacob,
it was me, 82AQ. Do you think that I'm going back to your RFID on the transmission line, or distribution for that matter. Do you think that it could be designed in a way where it could be powered from the incoming, the reference current that you get from the CC output, so that you would be able to store information? And the reason I say that, I ask that, is because I don't see much need to be able to read it real time, because every transmission line is originating and terminating at a substation where there's, they know what's coming in and going out on that line. But, let me let it drop. I could see a big use for it, you know, when you have a fault on a line and you send a crew out to patrol, especially in the middle of the night, they're looking for a blasted insulator, so tracking. It would be really nice to be able to point up as you walk past each line, you know, each tower, point up and say, okay, yeah, we saw the fault current here, let's go to the next one. Oh, we saw the fault current here, let's go to the next one. Up, we didn't see fault current here, so we know the failure occurred between, you know, on this span. It would certainly make life, you know, when you're patrolling the lines a lot easier. I was just thinking out loud. 82AQC, back to next.
I'm waiting there. This just came back. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Extremely good idea you got there, John. Steve. Extremely good idea. The local magnetic field in the vicinity of those high tension distribution lines, transmission lines, is more than enough local power to keep the thing alive. There's more than enough bits that could be put into the right kind of an RFID tag where it could take a measurement every 10 seconds, every minute, every 5 minutes, whatever, and keep a record. In other words, you can now plot of what current it saw throughout the last X number of days. Absolutely very possible. And then as you pass each one of those tags, you download that information, look at that graph and say, yes, the fault occurred an hour ago here, and let's see if it's going to occur an hour ago at the next one downrange. Very doable what you're describing. And so the thing would be powered by just the local current flowing through that line, and you could even arrange it in such a way, let me drop, by way of the uninterruptible local power supply, so to speak, a small lithium battery, where even if the line went dead for X number of hours, the tag could continue to measure current and record it. So is that doable? Very doable. The technology is there. It's just a matter of somebody asking for it because there is a need. And the way you describe it to me, Steve, there is a need. That we sure would be nice to be able to drive down the length of a high-tension line and know what the past history of that line was at each one of those stations you want to stop and take a reading. So it's time you push for that product because the technology is more than there. There's a slim chance that it might already exist, Steve. KD2HUC, keep me track on that one. K2LIW, you got a good one.
Yeah, I don't even know if it would have to sample, Dick. I mean, when you construct a line, you have a general idea, you know, give or take the time of year and whatnot, what the maximum capacity of that line is, and you would just set it up for a trip point. Say, okay, when the current exceeds this level, store an event. You know, when it exceeds this level, store an event. And this way you don't, you know, needlessly fill up the buffer, or even, you know, as you pointed out, if you put a local battery, you know, you don't kill it running, you know, just storage. Because like I said, anything coming in and going out on that line is being recorded as a sub. But you just want, you know, past history of fault events, you know, overcurrents and such like that. This way, you know, the amount of activity that the device would have to do would be, you know, limited. But I could definitely see that, especially lines that go on for miles. I could definitely see that. Back to you, baby QH.
Very fine, Steve. You got a darn good idea. And so that should be pursued. That's an answer waiting for somebody to ask the question. The answer is already there. The capability is there. One of the fun things you can ask a person who is not completely familiar with RFID is the following puzzle. In order to be license-free, in order not to be jamming somebody's cordless phone, every fraction of a second the thing is jumping to another frequency, a pseudo-random set of frequencies, every 50 kc up the band, so to speak, between 902 and 928, or is it 500 kc? You've got roughly 50 channels between 902 and 928. So it's a fraction of a megacycle between the frequency hops and the pseudo-random code. So the interrogator must do that. This 20-cent tag is responding to you, and you ask somebody, what do you think is the frequency accuracy of the tag talking back to you? It's a trick question. The answer is the frequency accuracy. Some people say, is it to the nearest megacycle? Is it to the nearest 100 kc? Is it to the nearest 10 kc? Let me drop it. The answer is the tag talks back to you with a frequency accuracy to the nearest 1 hertz. And even that 1 hertz depends on how fast you're moving toward the tag or away from the tag by way of the Doppler shift that you are creating. The tag has no frequency accuracy generating devices on board. There's no crystal on board. It is taking your signal and reflecting it back to you. So the signal it sends back is the identical frequency you send to it. It's just modulating the impedance of the antenna in order to change the reflectivity of the antenna, and that is the downlink information that you read, that modulation going up and down in amplitude. You're reading those leading edges and trailing edges and converting that back into a digital code. It's a very crafty device. So they're going to be around a long time, and as time goes on, they're going to get a little bit more sensitive, although they're already pushing the state of the art to operate down to minus 15 or minus 18 dBm at the antenna, at the chip, in order to wake it up. Let me drop. And so the tag itself is going to have all kinds of capability. There are advertisements we've seen where, in theory, in a high-end clothing store, every one of your designer pair of pants and blouses and everything else is going to have an RFID tag. And then all night long, the equipment installed in the ceiling of the building is doing automatic inventory. And you pick up the right pair of pants, the right blouse, socks, and everything else you want, put it in your cart, and walk out the front door without stopping at the checkout counter, because the antenna at the front door reads all those tags. Know what you just bought. It already has read your piece of identification, probably a card from that store, which identifies you. So therefore, it knows who to send the bill to. It all goes on your credit card as you walk out the door. There are advertisements that are made that way for food stores and clothing stores and so on. It's a bit of an exaggeration. It isn't quite there yet, but there are people moving in that direction, and RFID is part of what's going to make that happen. So, as you can tell, it's a good set of questions that were asked to you on that subject, John. We've gone a little bit further than what I think the questioner asked, but I think it's a good subject to get into. KC2WGB, Fancy RF, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Yep, more information is better than less, that's for sure. And remind me later, I do have a question from a youngster for Paul on the space report. He has a question for him. All right, now I'll go on to my next antenna question here, which just came in over the, let's see. Yep, that came over the computer. Hold on, let me come back. Let me let it drop.
Was that chat room or Echo Link?
This came name over the chat room. Gentleman is interested in a dipole antenna, which is center-fed, and he believes that it transmits resonant on every third harmonic. He'd like to know if he's correct in assuming this, that now if he goes to an offset center, but not center-fed, but an offset-fed, at one-third off the center, does it transmit on every harmonic now? If you can understand that question, Dick.
Yeah, the origin of that question could be the May issue of QST Magazine 2016 in the section called The Doctor Is In. The leading question was somebody asked for a 3-to-1 frequency response capability antenna, and the implication was that it was off-center fed, it would do it better. I think the answer is no. Partially no. Let me show you why. A dipole itself operates beautifully on the fundamental and all of the odd harmonics, third, fifth, seventh, and so on. It starts coming back to a reasonable impedance, not perfect, at all of the odd harmonics. At the even harmonics, the dipole, when center-fed, goes from a 70-ohm impedance to something like a 1,500-ohm impedance. That's not an easy one to feed. Very few antenna tuners are going to have enough range. If you feed the antenna with open wire lines, you can do that. If you fed it with coax, and you got a 1,500-ohm impedance, which is what, a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio, so 50-to-1 standing wave, it's a huge standing wave ratio. Your coax cable is going to give you a lot of loss. Open wire line can tolerate that, and people have done it. Now, you can feed the dipole anywhere you want. Let me drop it. With the right kind of a balancing device, you can decide to feed the dipole center, halfway from center to the outer edge, or anywhere in between. You get different impedances in those different locations. But if you're smart enough to build the right kind of an impedance matching device, because you've gone to the Berkeley program, you've Googled the word Berkeley plus impedance match, and by way of your antenna tuner, or by way of your understanding of the Brown and Woodward curves, you now know exactly what impedance, resistive component, and reactive component your antenna is going to be at that frequency, at that point of feeding it. The raw data is there for you to calculate that ahead of time. And you can add that, you can tell the Berkeley program, this is the resistive component and reactive component of my antenna, and this is the impedance of my transmitter, 50 ohms resistive and 0 ohms reactive, and this is the frequency I'm operating at this time. You press go, and in 1 second you get 16 solutions with the diagram, with the values. Choose the one you like. So the good news is that the dipole can be fed anywhere, and the dipole on odd harmonic frequencies has reasonable impedance. On the even frequencies, in the center, as the example I gave, 70 ohms goes to 1,500 ohms. As long as you've got the right kind of a network you can switch in, which can tolerate a 15-ohm center impedance, then there's nothing stopping you from feeding it on the even frequencies. I mean, what it's going to do is thoroughly predictable. You can anticipate that and make a switching arrangement that handles that new impedance at the even frequencies. Let me drop. Now, there's a little bit more going on here than meets the eye. When you go from an odd frequency like the fundamental to the second harmonic, the even frequency, you've got a fairly different pattern. Not that different. But the pattern does change. As you go to the higher harmonics at even and odd, the pattern gets more and more complicated. The average guy doesn't worry about that. But it's something else to be concerned with. And if the antenna itself is a basic inverted V, for instance, an ordinary dipole on all of these frequencies tends to have a null off the end if it's a flat dipole parallel to the ground. If it's an inverted V dipole, it radiates horizontally polarized broadside, vertically polarized off the ends, and there are no nulls. It's always radiating a signal somewhere, if you know what I mean. So an inverted V dipole, fed wherever you like, with the right kind of a switching network, you can feed it on all the frequencies in the world. Let me drop. All the tradition of antennas is that you want to feed them on the fundamental frequency near the center, where you get 73 ohms of resistive impedance, very little reactance, That is the tradition. Now that we've got capability of very low loss transmission lines, like 450 ohm lateral line, 600 ohm open wire line, that can tolerate an extremely high vis loss, by way of you adding an extra switching network or buying a very wide range antenna tuner, can make any length of wire radiate for you. Your antenna tuner, in all those cases, is going to bring it into resonance. You resonate the antenna first, then it can radiate. The antenna that's inside of your cell phone, which no longer has a whip sticking out on the outside, let me drop, is much too small and is nowhere near elaborate enough to work on all of those frequencies that your cell phone works on. To get around that problem, by literally putting a integrated circuit chip connected directly to that antenna, which is an antenna tuner. There's nothing magic about the antenna being a resonant length physically. You can electronically resonate it if you've got an antenna tuner with a wide enough antenna tuning range that anticipates your particular location. Every one of your cell phones does that. Those antennas in there don't have anywhere near enough frequency bandwidth and enough frequency bands to cover all of the various services that you want to cover on a smartphone. It's done with an antenna tuner. We amateurs are smart enough to either homebrew, build, or buy antenna tuner. By way of that Berkeley program, you can find out that at this particular frequency where the antenna is a 1500 ohm impedance, you put them, I'm picking numbers out of the air now, an 8 microhenry inductor in series with a 37 picofarad capacitor, and now that will give you a step-up impedance from 50 ohms to 1500 at your operating frequency. I picked those numbers out of the air, but Berkeley will tell you. And for you to make a that many microhenry coil by winding the right number of turns on a piece of a PVC pipe, for instance, and to make that transmitting-grade capacitor by way of two pieces of a copper tape on opposite sides of a thin piece of plastic that gives you the right number of picofarads and can tolerate those high voltages of a transmitter, for you to homebrew that antenna tuning device to make your antenna operate on whatever frequency you want, you've got the capability of doing that. You don't have to force the antenna to be in resonance anymore. If your property is not big enough to make a 160-meter antenna,
repeater, timeout,
and you've only got a piece of property for not a half-wave dipole, but a quarter wavelength, and it's going to be a huge impedance on 160 meters, but you can force that piece of wire you've got out there to resonate on 160 meters with the right kind of an antenna tuner. The Brown and Woodward curves will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get, and you can know what impedance you're going to get, and you can tune for that, and therefore you can force it to work. So the tradition is to always make the antenna resonant. You're not forced to do that anymore. You have the capability of using any length of wire on any frequency that you care about, if you're smart enough. I didn't say it's easy. I'm just telling you it is very doable. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. A lot of fun antennas. One question, which I know will probably want the answer to, but hasn't been asked. The effective range of a good antenna tuner, would you say that would be 7 to 1 or 10 to 1, Dick? What do you think is more possible?
Yeah, very logical sounding question, John. But there is no simple answer to it. If the manufacturer of an antenna tuner was really doing a thorough job, he would give you a Smith chart for each individual band appropriate for his particular antenna tuner, that particular model number. The reason I chose Smith chart is that a Smith chart, once you understand what it is, every possible impedance in the world is somewhere, is a dot somewhere on that chart. So your antenna tuner, what will it do on 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters? They would give you a Smith chart on each one of those bands, and a certain portion of the Smith chart would be covered, colored in. These are the portions where the Smith chart, where the antenna tuner will give you a perfect match. And the places where it's not colored in, it doesn't give you a perfect match. Okay? Now you look at the colored in portion. Depending on the phase angle of the reflection signal of your particular antenna, there are portions where that colored in region might have a ratio of the resistive component versus 50 ohms might be 25 to 1 in one particular corner of the Smith chart where the antenna tuner will work for you. And in some other portion of the Smith chart, because of that particular phase angle and the degree of matching it, maybe it can only tolerate a 3-to-1. So there is no fixed number. That's the reason why, let me drop this. In many cases, your particular antenna tuner runs out of range, will not give you a match at your favorite frequency with this particular antenna. And if you just add a random length of transmission line, it's a 50-ohm cable, we'll say, and you add 5 more feet, 10 more feet, 15 more feet of 50-ohm cable with the adapters in the shack, that extra length of line takes the crazy impedance of your particular antenna, which was a dot somewhere on that Smith chart, and now you take your compass, put the sharp point of the compass in the center of the Smith chart, put the pencil on the dot that used to be there, and now you start sweeping clockwise. That's what that extra length of line is doing. It's not changing the visual, it's changing the phase angle. By way of you sweeping that compass, by adding an extra length of line, so to speak, you can easily go from the portion of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner does not work, and you've now swept it into the portion where it does work. Every antenna tuner has that characteristic. And if your manufacturer had really give you all of those colors in Smith charts, you'd know that ahead of time. But we amateurs are very good at experimenting. Let me drop. You just start adding random lengths of transmission line, of low-loss transmission line, to your feed line, to your antenna, and I'll bet you 85% of the time, a particular antenna at a particular frequency that will not tune for you, you will bring it into tuning with that random length of line. So there is no fixed number, as you can tell, John. The number could be pretty big and pretty small, depending on your particular phase angle of the reflection of your particular antenna and your particular model of antenna tuner. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. The question has been implied on a couple of letters, and that's why I wanted to cover that, because they thought that they could count on a specific range on a certain type of tuner. So I'm glad you explained that. Okay, I'll let it drop. I'm going to go on to this question from a youngster who's only 12 years old, and he had questions for his science teacher, but the teacher didn't handle it well. So his brother, who listens to the TechNet, told him to submit the question here, and then he might get an answer. So let me let you drop, and I'll give you the question. Okay, this youngster, 12 years old. You have an aircraft at the equator, and you take off, and you fly east. And you have the rotation of the Earth. Your plane, which is approximately 1,000 miles an hour. Your plane is going 500 miles an hour. How come your target landing is not receding from you at 500 miles an hour? How do you ever get there? Great question, Dick. Over to you, KC2WGB.
I guess it's a little bit equivalent to a flea that's on the back of a dog. The dog is galloping down the road, but that flea is down, buried somewhere in the thick fur of the dog. And except for the fact that the dog's bouncing up and down a little bit, he doesn't know he's moving 25 miles an hour, if you know what I mean. He doesn't know it. He just knows what's happening as he moves along the skin of that dog. Although the equator of this Earth is traveling at something like 1,000 miles an hour because the Earth is rotating, that's 1,000 miles an hour with reference to what? With reference to the sun, the moon, and the fixed stars. Well, you and I tend to not measure our speed compared to the sun, the moon, and the fixed stars. 1,000 miles an hour sounds like an extremely fast speed, but everything we do, with rare exception, unless you're in the International Space Station where you're moving 17,500 miles an hour, that's the speed. And now when you're moving that fast, you see a sunrise and a sunset every 90 minutes. Let me drop. But whether you're on the equator and you measure your weight with a scale, and you try to measure your speed with anything that's with reference to the dirt you're standing on, or if you're standing at the equator, and you measure your weight on the scale, and you measure your speed of your vehicle with reference to the dirt you're standing on or driving over, there's no real difference. Everything you do is with reference to your local surroundings. Yes, if you're a good astronomer, and you stare at the moon, the stars, and whatever, the stars in particular, all of those stars in the sky will move 15 degrees per hour. Unless you've got a pretty high-gain telescope aimed at one of those stars, you won't even see that motion. You lie on your back on a chaise lounge at nighttime when your eyes are dark adapted, and you stare at that sky. Where you are here on Long Island, you're moving at 700 miles an hour. You don't know that. The stars move to you so slowly that if you choose a particular star that's behind a particular branch of a particular tree, and you look at it 15 minutes later, 30 minutes later, you will sense that it's moving 15 degrees per hour. Your hand, if you hold your fist outstretched in front of you, from the top of your fist to the bottom of your fist is roughly 10 degrees, 15 degrees per hour. 1.5 fists per hour is the rate at which those stars move. Let me drop quick. And the moon, by the way, doesn't move 15 degrees per hour, moves something like 14.5 degrees per hour, because it's once every 28 days going around the Earth in the same direction. Top view, everything in this solar system is counterclockwise, with rare exception. Top view, the Earth turns counterclockwise. The moon goes around us counterclockwise once every 28 days. We go around the sun once every 365 days. Top view, if you know what I mean. Another interesting question you can ask people is that if I'm looking at a particular star, how many times does it rise and set during a particular year? And the answer is not 365, it's 366. The sun rises 365 times. A star will rise 366 times. Because while the Earth is rotating and you see the sun rise and set 365 times, you're going around the sun and you're picking up one more rotation. That star moves 366 times per year up and down. That's the reason why the sidereal clock and the diurnal clock gain one day per year. That's why the sidereal clock, an hour on it is 56 minutes and 4, I forgot how many minutes it is, 55 minutes, 56 minutes per hour. It's not the same 60 minutes per hour. It's a so-called a star clock because of this one day difference. So, let me drop. The best that I know of where anybody has come along this situation is in the case of the SR-71 aircraft. For a short period of time, I worked on that aircraft. That aircraft can fly 2,300 miles an hour. Therefore, it is possible in that aircraft to fly from west to east. Let me think it is now. West to east? East to west. East to west. You can see, flying in that airplane, you can see two sunsets in one day. Or you can take off from New York at noon and arrive at London at 11 o'clock in the morning. You can arrive earlier than you left, even though London is usually 4 hours ahead of us. Because you can move 2,300 miles an hour, you get some funny things going on with your internal clock, if you know what I mean. But that's a rare situation. So almost all of our speeds that we measure are with reference to the dirt that we're standing on, driving over, and so on. So the speed at which you're moving compared to the celestial objects is academic. You do not sense it, if you know what I mean. That's part of the answer. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Okay, I just thought it was a good question, and he couldn't get an answer that made any sense from his teacher. So, very good. All right, that's it from the mailbag tonight, and let's go over to Paul and see what he has and all that information. KC2WGB. Oh, by the way, let me just put out my email address at, let's see, it's at AOL, so it's Juliet Bravo 5 Oscar at AOL.com. If you have any questions you wish them presented, just post them up to me and I'll get them on the air. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, it finally came to me the difference between a sidereal clock and a diurnal clock. The ordinary clock we all use, one day is exactly 24 hours, per se. Fraction, you know, microsecond more or less, but 24 hours is a day. On a star clock, a sidereal clock, one day is not 24 hours, 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. That's what one day, in other words, you're looking at a particular star, rising and setting, and you time the time that it goes by that church steeple, and you're looking at a clock, and you wait until the very next day that star goes by that same church steeple again. You think it's going to be 24 hours later. That star will cross that church steeple from your particular window 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds later. That's because there's 366 days per year on a star clock. That's how many times the Earth really rotates. The Earth really rotates 366 times. But because we go around the sun, we only see the sun rise 365 times. That's 366. Okay, so what is NASA doing? I got a good guess as to what Voyager is doing. The last we knew, Voyager was something like 134 astronomical units and something like 36 hours of round-trip time to talk to it. It's really out there. That's DX. So, Paul, with the space report, it's going to be space report number 198. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2S, K2RIW and the TechNet.
With comment.
Go ahead, identify yourself and then go ahead with your comment.
We're over 37 hours now on Voyager 1. I heard a quick comment there.
This is K1MJM, mic number 2. I just wanted to tell Paul that the information he sent me is up on the webpage on the SpaceNet report. K1MJM, clear.
Okay, let me see if I have it, Dick.
Yeah, tell us what you just added to the mic number 2 website, the one that's at limarktechnet.com. Over to you, Paul, and wait for all four beeps. And try to remember once every minute to give an interrupt.
Okay, very good. And thank you, Mike. I sent that net, I think, a day or so ago. And I just wanted to confirm that if I gave you a quick call, but nobody was home. So let me wait for the net. Maybe you'll be on. So thank you, Mike. Let me turn it over to Mike first. I guess it will. I sent a PDF. Good enough, right?
Yeah, Roger. I uploaded the PDF onto the space report page, so you can just click on it and the entire PDF comes up. K1MJM, over to you, Paul. I'm all done. Yep.
Thank you very much, Mike. Very well done. I'll check it out later. Okay. Well, yeah, Dick. I just wanted to send some kind of an update. I haven't sent anything forever. But this deals with the CRS 8 mission that we talked about many times on this net. The Falcon 9 went up and it brought up the Beam spacecraft. It's the whole story dealing with not only the Beam module being, you know, docked and properly to the space station, but also the events that transpired with the Boopster. You know, that's the first time they were able to actually land a booster safely on a barge, really a ship, out in the middle of the ocean and bring it back safely. So step-by-step story about what went on with that, Dick, so you can check that out later. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds like kind of fun stuff, Paul. And do remember that John does have a question that was given to him that's supposed to be added to the space report. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Okay, very good. And you'll see pictures and everything about that particular story. John, you had a question. Was that the question that the 12-year-old had